that subject, but I'm going to go ahead and do it in a broad and general way, give the background before going on to the kind of interpretation and application. In the book of Exodus, we have the story of God taking a nation for himself. When you come through the book of Genesis and you have the table of nations in the 10th chapter, and then the Tower of Babel in the 11th chapter describing the scattering of the nations, then you have the story of God choosing a man. And that man that he chose was Abraham, and there's a lineage given there that brings us down to Abraham. And it was God's determination to make a nation out of that man and his family. In fact, there would be nations that came from Abraham, but one nation in particular that would be a nation that belonged to God. And in order to accomplish that, over a series of generations, the descendants of Abraham ended up in Egypt, where they were nurtured and where they grew into a vast number of people. And the opening chapters of the book of Exodus describe how they grew into a great multitude in Egypt, how the Egyptians then began to oppress them, to kill their boy babies, and to enslave the people. And God then chose Moses to lead the people out of Egypt. And when God chose Moses, one of the things that he told Moses is that Pharaoh will resist. Pharaoh will have a hard heart. He will not listen to what you say. Pharaoh will not obey what I say for him to do. But God said to Moses in Exodus chapter 4, verses 22 and 23, that when Pharaoh refused to let the people go, you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. Israel is my firstborn son. And I say to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. Now that's the backdrop for the story of Passover. Israel is God's firstborn son. And we're going to be thinking about God's firstborn son. And if you refuse to let him go, I will kill your firstborn son. So we go through the story of the plagues, the 10 plagues that God brought upon Egypt. And the last of those plagues, after Pharaoh had hardened his heart and God had hardened Pharaoh's heart after this series of events, the last of those plagues is described for us in the 12th chapter of the book of Exodus. But the prelude is in the 11th chapter of the book of Exodus. Exodus 11, verses 4 through 8. Moses has had a conversation with Pharaoh here after the 9 plagues, and repeatedly Pharaoh has said, okay, I'll let the people go, and then he's reneged on the deal and would not let the people go. His own people have pleaded with him. His own advisors have pleaded with him, let the people go. This is ruining the land of Egypt. And it literally ruined the land of Egypt. It destroyed Egypt. But the Pharaoh was unrelenting. And so in this final episode, the Pharaoh says to Moses, I've had it. If you ever come into my presence again, I will have you killed. Don't ever come back. Don't talk to me again. And Moses, in great anger, says, indeed, that's how it's going to be. This is the last thing. This is the end of the deal. And so Moses says in Exodus chapter 11, verses 4 and following, so Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight, I will go out in the midst of Egypt. I will go out in the midst of Egypt. And every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle. There shall be a great cry throughout the land of Egypt, such as there has never been, nor ever will be again. But not a dog shall growl in all the land of Goshen against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you may know the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And all these your servants shall come down to me. That is the Egyptian, the aristocrats of Egypt. All these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, get out, you and all the people who follow you. And after that, I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. And that's an important part of the story. Moses didn't want it to come to this. Remember, he was raised in Egypt. He was raised in the house of the Pharaoh as a son of the princess. He didn't hate the Egyptian people. He didn't want to see this happen to Egypt. He went out in hot anger because he hated what he saw happening there. He hated this consequence because it didn't have to be that way. except it did have to be that way. Because of their rebellion, because of the sin, because of the resistance to God, it did have to be that way. But God was taking one nation out of another nation. He was bringing a nation into being by this process. And so we come to Exodus chapter 12 and the instructions for the Passover. Exodus chapter 12, the first three verses tell us when this was, when it was going to happen. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household." And then it proceeds to describe what they are to do with these lambs that they take. The first day of the month. This is the beginning of Mishri. This is the spring of the year. This is the month is called Abib in this area, and then later on in the Bible, when the children of Israel have a change of language after the Babylonian captivity, is called Nisan. The month of Abib, the first month, and it is in the spring of the year. This is the beginning of barley harvest. It wasn't really the beginning of harvest that year in Egypt because the barley had been destroyed by the hail and by the locust. But that's what it was, is the beginning of barley harvest. That's the beginning of the year for the Israelites in the spring. And if you know the sequence of feasts that follow after that, after Passover, as described later in the law, then came a Sabbath day, and the day after the Sabbath, they had a waving of a sheaf of first fruits from the very first harvest of barley when they came into the land of Canaan. And then they counted seven Sabbaths, a total of seven Sabbaths. And after seven Sabbaths, then the next day was the Feast of Weeks or the Feast of Pentecost, when they celebrated the end of the harvest. And so we're going from generally about mid-April. It varies, of course, from year to year. But generally, Passover, Easter on our calendars typically, is about the middle of April. And then Pentecost is in early June. And there's 7 weeks in between those two. And this is initiating that. The beginning of their months is in the spring, the beginning of barley harvest, and then they have a harvest festival, Pentecost, after 7 weeks when the wheat harvest has been completed. So that's how this thing is going to play out in their calendars in years to come. But right now, in the moment, they're just about to leave Egypt. And barley harvest isn't going to amount to anything because, again, the locusts and the hail, these things have been destroyed. But here they are in the final play, the final episode of the 10 plagues. And God says, and this is about 7 weeks later, when they are at Sinai, God says in Exodus chapter 19, when the Israelites are about, after 3 days, to receive the Ten Commandments, God says in Exodus chapter 19, after they have spent the 7 weeks or so wandering in the desert, and they are now in the third month of their calendar, God says to Moses in verses 5 and 6 of Exodus 19, If Israel, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. But not all the earth acted like it was his. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. You will be my treasured possession out of all the nations. Even though all the earth is under his dominion, you'll be my treasured possession out of all the nations. You will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That was the premise on which the Passover was initially grounded, that they would be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. When we go over to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 34, 40 years later, when Moses is rehearsing the experiences in the desert and God's commandments to the people of Israel, in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 34, Moses says, "There's never been anything like this any other time in the world, that God has taken a nation out of another nation to claim it for his very own." And this is an important part of the process here. God was creating a new nation, a new kingdom, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. He was bringing a new nation into being. And the Passover was a fundamental part of that, which is a fundamental part of the story that I want us to think about tonight. Deuteronomy 4:34, "Has any God ever attempted to go and take a nation for himself from the midst of another nation, by trials, by signs, by wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great deeds of terror, all of which the Lord God did for you in Egypt before your eyes?" So you saw God forming a nation, bringing them out of the crucible that was Egypt to be his people, his chosen people, which they would become there in the desert. They would become a nation. So God has a goal in mind, and the Passover is a necessary step in that process to bring one nation out of another nation and to have them become His covenant people. So going back to Exodus chapter 12, verses 3 through 5, we have the basic elements of the Passover described here. They're to take a lamb, and it is to be a lamb without blemish. No sign upon it of any imperfection. It's to be a lamb that has no marks or imperfections on it. They are to acquire this lamb on the 10th day of the month and to set it aside until the 14th day of the month. And then at twilight on the 14th day, which is sometime, at least as it developed over time, sometime between, say, 3 and 5 o'clock. At twilight on the 14th day of the month, they are then to sacrifice that lamb. In chapter 12, verse 6 of Exodus, keep it till the 14th day of the month when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs at twilight. And on that first Passover, and I emphasize this is the first Passover, on that first Passover, every head of household was killing the lamb for his own household. Everyone at the same time, at twilight on the 14th, in order to roast it and to cook it, as the description goes on to say. And when they were killing those lambs, they were to collect some of that blood, and then they were to take a bunch of hyssop, and they were to dip the hyssop in the blood, and Exodus 12:7, they were then to take the blood of the lamb, which they were sacrificing, and it is specifically called a sacrifice, and they were to take that blood, and they were to put it, the word says they were to slap it, actually, literally, they were to slap that blood with the bunch of hyssop on the doorposts on each side, as well as on the lintel over the top of the door. So we have blood on the doorpost here, blood on the doorpost there, blood on the lintel over the top of the door. And it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, not on the threshold. Okay, they weren't putting blood on the threshold where they would walk over. They're putting blood on the two sides and the top as they're making preparation for the Passover here. It goes on and it says that they were to roast this lamb. The lamb was to be roasted with bitter herbs. And those bitter herbs were staples in the land of Egypt. They weren't necessarily going to be available to them when what turned out to be the years of wilderness wandering, but they had those readily available in the land of Egypt. If you wonder what bitter herbs are, what's very typical today, which doesn't necessarily say what they had then, are such things as horseradish and romaine, but things that are along those same lines. And we're told that the bitter herbs were a symbol, a reminder of the bitter experience they'd had in Egypt. And that was described in the book of Exodus back in the first chapter, that as they were oppressed by the Egyptian people and the Pharaoh, that their suffering was bitter. And so the bitter herbs are going to be a reminder of the bitter experiences they had had in Egypt. And they were to roast the lamb over the fire. Now, you and I, if we think of roasting, we may think of in terms of taking a pan and putting it in the pan and putting it in the oven with a cover on it. But for them, roasting meant it wasn't going to be cooked in a pot. They were not to seethe it. They were not to boil it. They were to cook it. And this is a shepherd's way of cooking a lamb. This is a traveler's way of cooking a lamb, because part of the point of this meal is that you are about to go. And so they're cooking this like on a spit over a fire. It's being roasted over a fire. And then the storyline goes on, and having put the blood on the doorpost, having gone in and closed the door, they're to roast it, they're to eat it with unleavened bread. Several days back when they're getting the lamb ready to be slaughtered on the 10th day, they're also to get rid of all the leaven in their households, all of the yeast. Now, you know, maybe you do or don't know, that yeast is in the air all around you. And it doesn't take very long if you put out some flour and water, and especially if it's in sugar, but or whole grain flour is better than white flour. But you put out some flour and water, and pretty soon it's going to collect yeast from the air. That's how you get a sourdough starter going. And that yeast from the air, that's the kind of leaven that they didn't go to the grocery store and buy a little packet of Fleischmann's yeast or whatever. They collected their yeast in this natural way. But several days before Passover, they're to throw out all the yeast. And they are to not have that, and they are to make unleavened bread. And later on, we're going to see that there's a specific point and application that's to be made from that. But the immediate point is, this is quick bread. You don't sit around and let this bread rise and get fluffy. This is bread that you very hastily mix it up, and you throw it onto a hot stone, and you cook it. This is hasty bread that they're making. Because, again, the emphasis is on the fact that they are about to go. They are going to leave Egypt before very many hours go by. And God says that they are to be dressed for travel when they eat this meal. They are to be dressed for travel, to be ready to go. Because as Moses had said to Pharaoh, when this happens, your people are going to be begging us to go. They'll have had enough of us, and they will want us to go. And that, again, is exactly how it all transpired. They were to be dressed for travel, according to chapter 12 and verse 11. So the intent that God expressed here is that all the firstborn of Egypt are going to die. And if you look back and you look at the backstory of what was going on in Egypt and the attitude of Egypt toward the Israelites and the attitude of the Pharaoh and the aristocrats, you see that there is a kind of justice that's going on here. The oppression, they brought this on themselves by their stubbornness, by their rejection of God, by their sins against the Israelite people, the oppression of the foreigners among them. They have brought this on themselves. And so God says that all the firstborn of Egypt are going to die, and not only the firstborn of the people, but the firstborn of the animals are all going to die as well. And there will not be a house in Egypt without someone dying. There will be death all through the land of Egypt. And God says in verse 12, chapter 12, verse 12, I will pass through Egypt, and I will strike all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. Now, I just want to proffer to you the notion, which I'm not going to dwell on, but I do want to just proffer to you the notion that when he says, I will pass judgment on all the gods of Egypt, he probably does not just mean idols that have nothing behind them. Okay, there are a number of scriptures that speak to the idea that idolatry and the work of demons are tied up together. These things, such as, for example, Deuteronomy 32 and 17, where God says that things offered to idols are offered to demons. And Paul restates that over in the book of 1 Corinthians. And I want to say this now because I don't want to wait and then forget to say it later. In the book of Colossians, because we're going to be connecting this story of Passover with the story of Jesus. In the book of Colossians, Paul talks about the fact that Jesus has brought about a victory against real spiritual forces. And I think when God says he's going to execute judgment on all the gods of Egypt, he's talking about spiritual forces that have real influence in lands that have gone astray and have abandoned the way of the Lord. And Paul wrote that Jesus had triumphed in the cross. This is in Colossians 2:15, and in fact in verses 13 through 15, Paul says, you were dead in your trespasses and sins and the uncircumcision of your flesh, and God made you alive with Christ, having forgiven us all our trespasses, by canceling the record of death that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. And when he says rulers and authorities, he doesn't just mean Pilate and the priests. Other scriptures speak to the idea that we're talking about principalities and powers in the heavenly places. But Jesus triumphed over them, the powers of darkness, by the cross. And God here is triumphing over powers of darkness. This is not just a symbolic victory. But it is a symbolic victory as well. That night, when the firstborn are dying in Egypt, there's going to be a cow, there's going to be a bull in the temple of Apis that dies. And that's going to say that God has authority over this idolatry. All of these various animals that the Egyptians are using as objects of worship to their divine beings. There's going to be death in these various temples where they have these sacred animals, as well as in the houses of the various of all of the Egyptians, no matter what their rank may have been. And it's going to demonstrate the power of God versus the power of the gods of Egypt. This is a final blow. All the previous plagues have been testimonies against the gods of Egypt, but this is a final statement that God's power is the true dominion, the true authority, and the true power over all the gods that the Egyptians have worshipped. Now, God said in verse 12 that he himself was going to pass through Israel, pass over the houses of the Israelites, and pass through Egypt and bring about the death of the firstborn. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 28 echoes what we have here Exodus 12, 13 and Exodus 12, 23, that there will be a destroyer going through the land. Hebrews 11 and 28 says that Moses, by faith, told them to put the blood on the doorpost so that the destroyer didn't kill any of the firstborn of Israel. And the destroyer is referred to here in the 12th chapter of Exodus. And I want to suggest, because again, I want to emphasize that there is more going on here than simple physical things. That sometimes when God does things in this world, he does it through angelic entities, right? we know that to be true. He makes his angels flames of fire and winds and so forth. He generally, in the Old Testament, he always spoke to people through angels. He did his work through angels. And it's only, as Hebrews chapter 1 says, that he now has spoken to us through his Son. In the past, in various ways, he spoke to the fathers. And Hebrews makes the case that now we have this superior revelation through the Son of God who became a man and dealt with us. But previously, God dealt with humanity through angels. It was an angel of the Lord who appeared in the burning bush and spoke to Moses. These things were done through angels. Over in Psalm 78, the psalmist says that what God unleashed against Egypt was a band of evil angels, or most newer versions have a band of destroying angels that God unleashed against Egypt. And that's not distinctive. It's not unusual that God would work in such a way through angelic beings of various kinds. And when I say angelic beings, I don't necessarily mean the angels who dwell around the throne of God and give him glory, because Satan qualifies as an angelic being in the terms that I'm talking about. Remember in the book of Job, when the sons of God are gathered in the presence of God there, the divine council, so to speak, has come together there. And among those who have come before God is Satan. And God says to Satan, "Where have you been? Well, I've been going to and fro on the earth. Well, have you considered my servant Job?" And you know the things that follows there, where God lets Satan have an opportunity to take away Job's possessions, to destroy his family. And then in a second encounter, he allows Satan to take away Job's health, but he says, "But you can't take his life." And I don't know that the destroyer here is Satan, but I do want you to have a little bit of that frame of mind that when it says that God did this, and then it says that the destroyer would not enter into the houses of the Israelites, that God is using a supernatural force, a spiritual force, to accomplish these things according to other scriptures and in accord with other scriptures. And I want you to think about that, because we're going to talk about the destroyer a little bit later on in terms of a different Passover, an altogether different Passover. But the destroyer would pass among them. And if they had blood on the doorpost, the destroyer would not enter the home. But the Egyptians didn't have that protection. They didn't have doors that were sealed against destruction. And so the firstborn of Egypt would die when the destroyer passed among them, when the destroyer passed through. And they were specifically told that night that the blood would be a sign on their doorposts, and all of them were to stay behind closed doors that night. None of them were to go out. None of them were to go out in the street. That God's destroying agent would be at work. And so they were to stay behind closed doors on that first Passover night. And then in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 14, we're told that this was to be a perpetual memorial. They were to do this year after year and generation after generation. That's reiterated in chapter 12, verses 24 through 28, and it's reiterated several times later on in the law, that the Passover was going to be a recurrent event, and it was going to be year after year and generation after generation. On the 10th day of the first month, they would put the lamb aside. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight, they would slaughter the lamb, and then they would eat the lamb. This was going to be a recurring festival. In fact, when we read about it in the 23rd chapter of Leviticus or the 16th chapter of Deuteronomy, it's specifically described as a festival in which they were to travel. It was a pilgrimage festival. Well, how did it go from being something that they did in their houses the first time to something they did at the tabernacle and temple as the years and the generations went by? And the answer to that is related to what happened in Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 and 6. I mentioned that God said there that if they would keep his covenant, that they would be to him a holy nation, a treasured possession, a kingdom of priests, if they would keep his covenant. And Israel there, when Moses brought this message to them, they said, "Yes, we will keep God's covenant. We want to do that." And Moses said, "Okay, in 3 days, anytime you encounter 3 days in the Old Testament, you should stop and think, does this have something to do with the scripture Jesus would have looked at when he said, you know, it says 3 days. He kept bringing that up. And this is one of those scriptures that does speak to that, which is not our story tonight, but it does speak to that. But at any rate, after 3 days, the glory of God was going to come down on the mountain, and they were to prepare themselves for the glory of God to come down on the mountain. And you remember how that goes. When the glory of God comes down on the mountain, and there is rumbling, and there is thunder and lightning, and there's a sound of a trumpet, and there's fire on the mountain, and there are all these signs, and there's earthquake, all this stuff is going on, and then there's a voice that comes from the mountain. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." And as that voice talks to them, do you remember the reaction of the people of Israel? It says they drew back in fear. And after they drew back in fear, and this is not only stated for us here in the 20th chapter of Exodus, but it's also restated by Moses. He reminds the children of Israel this over in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 5, which is where I'm going to read from, we're told, and the reason I choose this is because here Moses explicitly says that the Ten Commandments were the covenant that God was giving to Israel. That was the covenant that he was giving to Israel at Sinai. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 2 through 5. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. That is to say, at Mount Sinai. In Horeb, at Sinai, God made a covenant with us. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord. For you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up on the mountain, up to the mountain. He said, and then we have the statement of the Ten Commandments, and after the Ten Commandments, which God said, spoke from the mountain, in verse 23, as soon as you heard the voice out of the midst of the darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes, and all your elders, and you said, behold, the Lord our God has shown us his glory and greatness, and we've heard the voice out of the midst of the fire. This day we've seen God speak with man, and man still live. Now, therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God anymore, we shall die. And they say, Moses, we really don't want to have this experience. We want you to talk to God, and then you tell us what God says. And Moses says, okay, God says, okay. And consequently, they truly did not become that kingdom of priests that God said they could become. Because when they heard God's voice, and that covenant was presented, instead of embracing it, they step back. And consequently, a tremendous change occurs from, I don't know what might have been, but they could have been a kingdom of priests in which everyone could approach God. And instead of that, when Moses then goes up on the mountain, Moses receives from God instructions to build a sanctuary. And Moses receives from God instructions to install a priesthood. Now, those things are not implied with the initial premise of the Passover and the initial premise of them being a kingdom of priests. But in the 25th chapter of Exodus, when Moses is up on the mountain, in verse 8, God says to Moses in the first 7 verses, take up a collection from the children of Israel. He tells them all the materials they'll need. And then in Exodus 25, verse 8, he says, and build a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And so they build a tabernacle. And then he goes on, and in chapter 28, he says, now take Aaron, your brother, and he's going to be the high priest, and here are the garments for Aaron, your brother, the priest, and his sons are going to be priests after him, and here are the garments for his sons, the priests, and here's how you are to consecrate them and to set them into place as priests. None of that is in the initial statement. I will make them a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, and they shall be to me a treasured possession. And over again, the prophets, including Samuel, in the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel, when the children of Israel come to Samuel and said, we want a king, so we can be like the other nations. And Samuel feels like, oh, they're rejecting me. And God says, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me as they always have done since the beginning when he brought them out of Egypt, as they always have done. They didn't want that relationship with God. They didn't want God as the king over them. They didn't want to have this priesthood. They didn't want to have that kind of relationship. But because of that change, or at least I believe it's because of that change, what happens with Passover is we have a commandment that comes out in relation to the sanctuary, the tabernacle, and then later on the temple. And the commandment is, Exodus chapter 17, verses 2 through 9, the commandment is that all sacrifices, blood offerings, have to be made at the sanctuary. Every sacrifice has to be brought to the sanctuary. And what did I say about Passover back in Exodus 12? It specifically says it is a Passover sacrifice. So they couldn't offer these sacrifices in their own households as they had done the first time. They couldn't do that. In fact, the timing of the second Passover, if we go to Exodus chapter 40, excuse me, in Exodus chapter 40, after they have finished the building of the tabernacle, we're told that they were ready now to put the tabernacle together, and the timing of that is significant, is important in the context of things that are happening. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, on the first day of the first month, so that's a year since he spoke to Aaron and Moses and said, this is the beginning of months for you. They've been now a year from the time when God first set their calendar in motion. The first day of the first month. When was Passover? the 14th day of the first month. So here they are. This is the first day of the first month of the second year. Now, the year after they have come out of Egypt. On the first day of the first month, God says to Moses, you shall erect the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. And what follows is a description of erecting the tabernacle. So at the beginning of the first month, the month of Abib, they now erect the tabernacle. And then Leviticus tells us about the sacrifices that they're to offer on the newly consecrated altar at the tabernacle. And if we go over to chapter 8 of Leviticus, we have the consecration of Aaron and his sons. First, you set up the tabernacle on the first day of the month, and then they spend a week consecrating Aaron and his sons to be priests so that the tabernacle is functional. And so chapters 8 and 9 describe the functioning of the tabernacle under Aaron and his sons and the faux pas, the mistakes that they made there. I do want to mention, before I forget about it and go back, when they set up the tabernacle in Exodus chapter 40, there on the first day of the month, they erected the tabernacle, the court, they finished the work. And then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And that's an important part of the story. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. We're going to come back around to that later. The glory of the Lord. So now we have, at the beginning of the first month, we have the tabernacle in place, the altar in place, we have the priesthood in place. And so we come to Numbers chapter 9. They're still at Mount Sinai. Numbers chapter 9. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the first month of the second year after they've come out of the land of Egypt. So they've been out of Egypt now for a year. God speaks to Moses there at Sinai. The tabernacle is in place. The priesthood is in place. And God said to Moses, let the people of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time. So what do they have the second Passover that they didn't have the first? Well, they have a tabernacle and they have a priesthood. And everybody brings the lambs to the tabernacle. They're not putting blood on the doorposts because guess what? They don't even have doorposts. Where are they? They're in tents in the desert, right? They're not putting blood on the doorposts. That was the first one, but they're not doing that. They're going, and the blood is being collected by the priests, and the blood is being thrown against the altar. That's what you did with sacrificial blood that was shed in the holy place. And as time goes by, we see that this is the recurrent event, is that they go to the temple for Passover. It was to be a pilgrimage feast, the children of Israel to go where the name of the Lord dwelt. That was at Shiloh for a while, and then it became Jerusalem. Jerusalem is referred to as the place where the name of the Lord dwelt. And they would go to Jerusalem for the Passover. They did not celebrate it in their homes. They went to Jerusalem for the Passover. And we have stories of the Passover a couple of different times. We have the second Passover there in Numbers chapter 9, where they have the tabernacle now ready before they observe the Passover for the second time. And then in Joshua chapter 5, we have the 40th year, when they enter the land of Canaan, and they cross the Jordan into Canaan on the 10th day of the month. That's the day when they're supposed to set aside the lamb. And then 4 days later, on the 14th day of the month, they celebrate the Passover at Gilgal, once the tabernacle has been set up at Gilgal, and that's their center of operations for quite a while. They set up the tabernacle at Gilgal, and they celebrate the Passover at Gilgal. And the next day, after the Passover, they eat some of the new grain in the land. You can't do that until first fruits, the waving of the sheaf, because God gets the first, and that's after Passover. But right after Passover, right after the waving of that sheaf of the first fruits, then they ate some of the fruit of the land for the first time, and the manna stopped. So Passover marked the end of the manna, the rolling back of the reproach, the years in the wilderness, all of that is, they've come full circle from Passover to Passover. And then we go down the line, we don't have Passover again until the days of Hezekiah. In the days of King Hezekiah, which is in Isaiah's generation in the 8th century B.C., we have an account of how King Hezekiah, in the 31st chapter of the book of 2 Chronicles, how King Hezekiah set out to observe the Passover. And mostly, it's an accounting of how they did it wrong. Because King Hezekiah intended to do good, he intended to do what was right, but they made a lot of mistakes. And when the first month and the 14th day of the month came around, they weren't ready, and they couldn't do it. But they looked back at Numbers 9, and they saw that here were some guys that were unclean, and God said, okay, people who were unclean on the day can wait a month and do it on the 14th day of the second month. And so all of Israel ended up doing it on the 14th day of the second month in Hezekiah's generation. And then Hezekiah had a problem that the priests and Levites, the priests in particular, were not consecrating themselves appropriately. And the story says that when the time came to offer the Passover sacrifices, the priests weren't ready to do it. And the Levites had done better about consecrating themselves, and so the Levites were actually cutting the throats of the lambs and skinning out the lambs. in order that the priest could take the blood and throw it against the altar. And then it says that they had invited people to come down from Israel to celebrate the Passover with them. And it says none of those people consecrated themselves. They hadn't gone through the purification rituals, and they were eating the Passover, and they were unclean. And so it says Hezekiah prayed to God, God, please heal the people, because he knew they were messing it all up. And it says, and God listened to Hezekiah's prayer, and he healed the people. And then 100 years later is the next time we have mention of the Passover, in the 35th chapter of 2 Chronicles. This one's also mentioned in 2 Kings, and that was King Josiah. And we're told that King Josiah, when he observed the Passover, no king in Israel had ever done it like he did. It hadn't been done like that since the days of Samuel the prophet. But Hezekiah had the advantage of having, they found the book of the law, you remember, and they rehearsed what the law commanded and so forth. And so they actually did it right. And there's this very strong commendation of King Hezekiah for doing the Passover right. We don't have a mention of the Passover again after that until we get to the book of Ezekiel. And I'm not going to get into interpretation of Ezekiel a whole lot tonight, but there's a couple of things I want to notice over in the book of Ezekiel in reference to the Passover. Ezekiel chapter 40, Ezekiel began to have a vision. And that vision is dated for us, the 25th year of our exile, in the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck down on that very day. The 10th day of the first month. What's that day? That's the day when they're supposed to set aside the lamb for the Passover. So Ezekiel has this vision immediately before the Passover. The vision of the future temple. A temple that was never built by human hands. But a temple vision that was fulfilled. A temple that was never built by human hands. The temple that was built by the exiles who came out was nothing like the temple that Ezekiel visualized there. But Ezekiel had this vision, and a part of his vision in the 45th chapter of Ezekiel was the celebration of the Passover in this new temple. And I call your attention to that because in Ezekiel chapter 45, verse 17, we're told that all the people of Israel were to bring offerings to the prince. And I want you to just take my word for it tonight that the prince is a reference to the Messiah, the one who was to come. Jesus is the prince that we're thinking about here in terms of fulfillment. And it shall be the prince's duty to furnish the burnt offerings, grain offerings, and that's what Jesus did. He supplied all of the offerings to fulfill all the requirements. That passage I read from Colossians, the law was nailed to the cross. He fulfilled all the sacrificial obligations. Thus says the Lord God, in the first month, on the first day of the month, you shall take a bull from the herd without blemish and purify the sanctuary. The priest shall take up some of the blood of the sin offering and put it on the doorposts, not the houses of all the families of Israel, but put it on the doorposts of the temple. So the blood is going to go on the doorposts of the temple. And previously, back in 41, when he's describing the temple, he specifically says the doorposts were square, which is to say like a post. Like you think of a fence post or whatever, 4x4 square kind of post. So they have these square posts, and the blood of the Passover, the blood of atonement, the blood of the sin offering at Passover, because he goes on and says, this is what you do. Verse 21, on the 14th day of the month, you shall celebrate the feast of the Passover for 7 days unleavened bread, the ritual previously described. This is the habit of the temple where the blood has been put on the doorposts of the temple. So we have this succession of Passovers in the Old Testament. We have a series of failures on the part of Israel to do and to keep the law and to follow through on what God said. And then we have modern Passover, and I just want to take a minute to talk about the modern Passover, because sometimes Christians, believers in Jesus, will be misled into thinking that you can look at the modern Passover Seder and think that you see what Jesus did on Passover night. And there's no connection between these things other than theoretical. There's no connection between these things. Jesus and his disciples, the lamb would have been offered at the temple as according to the commandments of the law. They would not have had, in fact, a Passover Seder. I have a little quote here from a newspaper, an Israeli newspaper called Haaretz, H-A-A-R-E-T-Z, an Israeli newspaper called Haaretz. It was an interview with an Israeli scholar, and the title of the article, which was published just a few days ago on June 27th, The title of the article is The Surprising Origins of Passover. The Surprising Origins of Passover. And he says a number of things in there that I didn't particularly agree with, assumptions on his part. But he said, the Passover Seder, that is what is practiced in Rabbinic Judaism by observant Jews, the Passover Seder is one of the most recognized and widely practiced Jewish rituals. Yet had our ancestors visited one of these modern-day celebrations, they would be baffled. And that's absolutely true. They would not know what's going on. They don't know what that Haggadah is. They don't know what those four cups of wine are. They don't. None of that was part of their experience. All of those things come up after the destruction of the temple. The modern Passover Seder is out of the Middle Ages, is out of the Mishnah, is out of the Talmud. It is not based on what they did in the Old Testament. There is no lamb on the Jewish table at Passover. There is a lamb bone, a shank of a lamb, which is ironic because one of the things I forgot to highlight, but one of the things that is said about the lamb, you remember, no bone of it shall be broken. So it's kind of ironic to have a lamb shank on the table, but there is no lamb on the table in a Jewish Seder ceremony. The Jewish Mishnah is the oldest source we have, which was compiled about 200 AD. The rabbis, after the destruction of the temple, generations went by when no one was observing the Passover, because there's no evidence that people were observing Passover in their homes in the diaspora, the dispersed Jews. It was a pilgrimage holiday. You went to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. There was no instruction for celebrating the Passover anywhere except in Jerusalem. But the rabbis began to be concerned that the Jews were going to lose their identity as a people if they didn't revive some of the rituals. And so they substituted. They revived the rituals and substituted new rituals for the old rituals in order to have a symbolic Passover observance. But don't suppose that if you look at a modern Jewish Seder, you get an insight into what Jesus did or what Moses did, because this is a symbolic representation from the rabbis rather than putting the scripture into practice. It can't be done because Passover requires a temple. In order to have Passover, you have to have a temple. So Rabbinic Judaism invented the modern Jewish Passover. You don't find that at all in terms of the biblical description and references. But if we go to 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verses 6 through 9, we have Paul here. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 6, we have Paul here saying, your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? What were they supposed to get rid of at Passover? And for a whole week afterward, no leaven. Don't you know a little leaven leavens the whole lump? And what's he go on to say? Get rid of, cleanse out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. You, the people of God, are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Now, he's saying that there is a new Passover. There is a new Passover, and the lamb of that new Passover is Jesus. He is the lamb of the new Passover. But our Passover has been sacrificed. Let us, therefore, Christians, let us celebrate the festival. Well, is that, you know, like once a year by making a pilgrimage? No. What was it originally? It was everyone, everywhere in their own household. And we have now rolled back the reproach of Israel and the failures of the first covenant. That's been nailed to the cross. Jesus has fulfilled Passover, and the church has fulfilled Pentecost. And so we have the new festival, as it were, the fulfillment of what it's all about. Let us celebrate the festival not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So when we look at Passover, we should, as Paul says, see that this was a prelude to the coming of Christ, that our Passover has been sacrificed. A lamb has been offered. And as the Apostle Peter explicitly says over in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 19, Jesus, his blood was offered as of a lamb without blemish. That's the description of the Passover lamb, a lamb without blemish. And we have repeated descriptions of Jesus by Paul in Hebrews and 1 Peter as him being without sin. Jesus was without sin. And so his sacrifice is the potentate of all sacrifices. His sacrifice fulfills all the sacrificial need. He is that prince who presents the sacrifices for all of the people once and for all. So I do want to notice, though, because I made some reference here to the idea of the destroyer that went through Goshen and Egypt, and it didn't kill anyone in Goshen because of the blood that was on the doorposts and the lintel, but it killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. The destroyer, right before Paul says, get rid of the old leaven, your boasting is not good, do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? The sentence just before that is, you are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction. Destruction. You are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, so that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord. Your boasting is not good. Get rid of the old leaven. When Paul uses that language, Satan the adversary and the destruction of the flesh, and then he talks about the leaven and the Passover lamb, he's drawing the contrast between being in the kingdom of darkness where the destroyer reigns, which is Satan, and the kingdom of light, where the Lamb has purchased our redemption, where we have been brought out of darkness into light. He is drawing that distinction by talking about Satan and then talking about purging out the old leaven and how our sacrifice, our Passover sacrifice, has been offered. Now, in order for our Passover sacrifice to have been offered, we needed, for one thing, a prelude, because where did Israel come from? They came out of Egypt. And you remember what Matthew says when the story of how Jesus was taken down into Egypt, and they stayed in Egypt until Herod, called the Great, died? You remember what Matthew says there? He reflects back on the experience of Israel because he's casting Jesus in the role. What did Moses tell Pharaoh? God told Moses, Moses told Pharaoh. What did he say that Israel was? Israel is my firstborn son. What's Jesus identified for us? He is God's firstborn son. What's Matthew say to us in Matthew 2:15? Jesus' family went into Egypt until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Out of Egypt, I called my son. So we're being told early on to reflect on the relevance of the story of Egypt, Israel coming out of Egypt in connection with the work of Jesus Christ. Now, in order to fulfill the Passover, and there was a question in the description that was given to me of the Passover door, the door that had the blood on the three sides of it there, the Passover door. Jesus didn't stay indoors that night, right? And I have said to you, well, part of the reason of that is because that after that first time, the destroyer was not abroad in the streets as it was that first night. They were in their tents, they were in their houses, they were in Jerusalem, and the destroyer was not abroad. It was a memorial. They weren't trying to save themselves from the destroyer with the blood. But there's a little bit more to the story here that I want to try and connect for you in a hopefully comprehensible way. In order to celebrate the Passover from the second year onward, they needed a tabernacle, they needed a temple. In the Gospel of John, when we read about Jesus coming into this world, Jesus is described as the living Word who came and dwelt among us. That's in John chapter 1, verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The literal word there is He tabernacled among us. And John definitely wants us to see the connection between the sanctuary and Jesus. He tabernacled among us. And this comes up over and over again in the book of John. In the second chapter of John, at Passover, Jesus goes up to Jerusalem. While Jesus was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, and I believe this is at the very beginning of his ministry, John chapter 2, verse 23, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew the people and needed no one to bear witness of him. Well, what's something that he did while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast? Well, just before that, it says, he went into the temple area, and he overturned the tables of the money changers, and he found people in there selling oxen and sheep and pigeons. So people are buying their sacrifices in what's called the court of the Gentiles. And that's a kind of a big deal, because Isaiah had prophesied, my house will be, and this is quoted the second time Jesus cleanses the temple, my house will be a house of prayer for all nations, but you've made it a den of robbers. They're fleecing people in what's supposed to be sacred ground. The Gentiles can't go into the area where the sacrifices are offered. They're not allowed to go in there, but they can come into the court of the Gentiles. And when they come in there, what do they find? Well, they find a marketplace of all things. This is a house of prayer for all nations, and Jesus took them to task for that. And this is at Passover, at the beginning of his ministry, that Jesus did that. And when Jesus is challenged, on what authority are you doing these things? Do you remember what he said? They said, give us a sign. Show us that you have the authority to do this. And you remember what he said to them when they asked for a sign? What sign will you show us for doing these things? John 2:19. Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I will raise it up. And the Jews said, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? And John says he was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. It's important to identify Jesus with the temple in understanding some aspects of the Passover. You remember I pointed out in Ezekiel, where did the blood go? The Passover blood, the atonement blood. What doorpost did it go on? It went on the doorpost of the temple, the new temple. There's no sign that they did that in Solomon's temple. In Solomon's temple, they threw it against the altar. But in the new temple, the blood was going to go on the doorpost. They were going to put the blood of the sin offering. They were to have the sacrifice of the Passover there. And that blood went on the doorposts of the temple. And what is Jesus saying here? Well, John tells us in 1:14 that he is the sanctuary, the tabernacle of God that dwelt among us. And Jesus himself says, my body is God's temple. Now, that's pertinent to us also, if you follow in the book of Acts. That's pertinent to us because what are we? We are the body of Christ, and we are the temple of God. And we celebrate the Lord's Passover as the temple of God. And the blood is on the doorposts because it's Jesus' blood that we're talking about. And we have a couple more connections yet to make here. And so we have in John chapter 2, verses 18 through 20, Jesus referencing himself as being the temple of God that was going to be torn down and then raised up again after 3 days, referring to his own death and then his resurrection. Jesus came back 3 years later, and he cleansed the temple a second time. This passage was referenced in a lesson a couple days ago in Mark chapter 11. Is that right? Mark chapter 11. In verses 1 through 11, we have the account of the triumphal entry. I think Dan referred to this on Sunday. We have the account of the triumphal entry, and that seems to be on Sunday. It seems to be on the first day of the week of the week of his suffering, the week that was going to result in his crucifixion. And it looks like, and I'm not saying this is an ironclad understanding of the chronology, because it's a little bit difficult to get the days all sorted out for sure, but it looks like to me that Jesus came back on he went to the temple. He rode the donkey into Jerusalem, and here comes Jerusalem's king. And he should have been received with accolades at the temple. But instead, it says he went to the temple, he looked around, he left, and went out to Bethany. And that is a complete... It's just the saddest thing that you could possibly imagine. That instead of being heralded, long live the king, nothing happens. The king comes to the temple to be received by his people, and nothing happens. The temple isn't ready to receive the king. And he looks around, and he leaves. And the next day, he curses the fig tree, he goes to the temple, and this seems to be Monday. I think it's Monday of that week, and I think it's the 10th day of the week on the calendar. I can't guarantee that, but I think it's the 10th day of the week. And I believe that that is the day on which Jesus now, the second time, cleanses the temple. John chapter 11, verse 15. They came to Jerusalem. He entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them, saying, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? And that's the kind of temple he was about to create. The new temple would truly be a house of prayer for all the nations. But he is cleansing the temple, very literally. He is consecrating the temple. Sacred things should be happening in the house of God, and they're not. And they should be. This should be a sacred place, but it's not. And so a new sacred place needs to be established, a sacred place where God can be worshipped as Jesus said to the woman at the well, in spirit and in truth. God is spirit, and those who worship him will worship in spirit and in truth. Not in Jerusalem and not on Mount Gerizim, but they will worship him in spirit and in truth, as went in that conversation back in John chapter 4. And when the scribes, the chief priests and the scribes heard it, they were seeking a way to destroy him. This is sort of the final catalyst, the straw that broke the camel's back. We have got to kill this guy because he is nothing but trouble for us when he cleansed the temple the second time. And again, this is at Passover. Passover to Passover, the ministry of Jesus, he cleanses the temple on both ends, and he prophesies, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. And in the middle of that is the lesson of the fig tree. And part of the lesson of the fig tree, the disciples are all impressed. Jesus curses the fig tree and it dies within a matter of hours. It totally dies. It withers. It's completely dead. And they can see that. And that's the first time they have ever seen Jesus curse anything. Jesus, time and time again, had the power to reduce his enemies to jelly, to do anything that he wanted to do. But what did he always do? And what did he teach them when they saw the fig tree? He says, well, you know, with faith you can do anything. And what you've got to do is you've got to forgive people. You've got to show restraint. You've got to exercise the grace of God. You've got to live in grace. And what had he done, and what was he going to do when he went to the cross? When they're reviling him, when they're abusing him, when they're beating him, when they're nailing him to the cross, when they're ridiculing him as he hangs on the cross, does he call forth the curse that he could? Does he strike the earth with a curse? He does not. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. He drives home the lesson of the fig tree. He has the power to destroy, but he's not the destroyer. Is there a destroyer? Well, yes, there is. And that's also reiterated several times in the Gospel of John. Jesus, on the night of his betrayal, he says to his disciples, "The ruler of this world is coming." Now, this is one of the reasons that Jesus is not behind closed doors on that night, the night after the Last Supper. Because what's he going to do? He's not going to hide behind the blood. He's going to provide the blood. He is not going to be safe from the destroyer. He is going to defeat the destroyer. He's going to meet the destroyer on his own turf, and he is going to defeat the destroyer. Through death, he destroyed him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and freed those who all their lives were held in bondage, Egypt bondage, held in bondage by their fear of death. He did not have sanctuary from the destroyer. He went out and faced the destroyer and overcame him on his own turf. And that's reiterated numerous times, but because I don't want to go on until midnight, I'm not going to take the time to read each of those scriptures. But that's reiterated for us repeatedly, that Jesus overcame the destroyer. He faced down the destroyer and overcame the destroyer. And so we have a new covenant, a new temple, which is his body, a new Passover, a new Pentecost, when he poured out the Holy Spirit in fulfillment of the blessings of Pentecost. The harvest festival has come. The law has been brought to completion through Jesus Christ. And the blood on the doorpost, I mentioned in passing in Ezekiel chapter 41, it says that the doorposts of that temple were square. And I just want you to think about the doorposts of the new temple. And I said that singular, not plural, because there is a doorpost and there is a lintel in the new temple. And the blood was on the doorpost and the lintel of the new temple, wasn't it? The blood of Jesus was on the doorpost and the lintel of the new temple. The temple that was purchased with his blood. The cross is the basis of the new Passover. It's in the cross of Christ that we find deliverance from sin, that we find our new Passover, our new Exodus, the fulfillment of the promises of God. And so Peter says to us, over in 1 Peter, the second chapter, that we, like living stones, are being built into a sanctuary, a temple for God, the new temple, the temple that Ezekiel is visualizing, the temple that is the body of Jesus Christ. He is the primary stone on which that temple is built. But each of us as living stones are being built into a holy priesthood and a temple in which God dwells by his Spirit. And then Peter goes on to say that those of us who have been purchased by Jesus, in verse 9, 1 Peter 2 and 9, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. I hope that you can remember enough of Exodus 19, 5 and 6 to realize that Peter is echoing what God said at Sinai. If you keep my covenant, you will be to me a treasured possession. Out of all nations, you will be my holy nation. You'll be a kingdom of priests, and I will bear you on eagle's wings. He promised if they would keep his covenant, this is what they would be. But what was their reaction? They drew back. And so they had to have a tabernacle and a temple and a priesthood and all those things. But Peter says now, Jesus Christ has made the new covenant reality that we are the temple of God. We are the holy nation. We are the priesthood that God wanted. We have a relationship with God that was kept at arm's length in that other covenant. But now it's been embraced. Jesus Christ has brought it home to us. We have this new covenant relationship with God. We are his own possession, that we may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That's not only referring to Passover night. Remember, the ninth of the plagues was the darkness in the land of Egypt. He's called us out of darkness and out of the power of Satan. The destroyer has been overcome, and we have been given new life in Christ. Once you were not a people, the Israelites in Egypt, they weren't a nation yet. He was calling a nation out of a nation. Now he is called a nation out of all the nations, a holy people out of all the nations. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. And there is nothing better than to know that you are the people of God. You are God's house. See, the blood is on the doorpost of the house because, as the writer of Hebrews says, Jesus built God's house, and you are God's house. You're the household of God, and the blood is on the doorpost because it's Jesus' blood on the cross that has purchased and made possible the household of God, the new temple, the new creation, the new priesthood. All of these things are fulfilled for us through Jesus Christ, and that's tremendous. Defeated armies don't charge. We're not a part of a defeated people. The Lord won the battle against the destroyer. The Lord has won every battle. The Lord wins, has won the battle. If you're a Christian, He's won the battle for you. You belong to Him. You are one of His holy people. If you're not a Christian, He's won the battle. You just need to take hold of that victory. You need to accept what He has accomplished. If there are any among us tonight who have not come under the blood of the Passover, that blood was shed for you. And you can have freedom from sin, and you can pass out of darkness into light, and you can have this relationship with God where you can approach Him any time, and He will listen to you. Come to God through Jesus Christ tonight if you need to be born again, if you need to become a part of His family, if you have not yet had the sprinkled blood of Passover on your own heart, if you have not yet been baptized to become a part of the body of Christ, come forward while we sing the song of invitation and take advantage of the tremendous victory that Jesus Christ has won for you. Let's stand and sing together. Okay.